Hi, this is Allison Sheridan of the NoCellaCast podcast, hosted at podfeet.com, a technology geek podcast with an ever so slight Macintosh bias. Today is Sunday, August 10th, 2014, and this is show number 483. Remember a while back there when I had to start every single show with a correction? Well, it looks like maybe we're back to that. Now, technically, it's not a correction, but a pretty major omission. In last week's show, I talked about DVDpedia for the Mac and how I could sync my library database over to iOS using Pocketpedia. For some dumb reason, I even never thought for a minute to check and see if Pocketpedia could do anything else. Well, luckily, Hearn on Twitter, he just happened to mention to me how much he likes Pocketpedia and how he uses it to scan books into Bookpedia. I couldn't believe it. What a great reviewer I am. Turns out you can use your iPhone or iPad's built-in camera to scan in your books, CDs, DVDs, and games, and they sync back nearly instantly to your Mac's PDF software, depending on which one you're running. I tried it, and it worked really, really well. Like I said, I sometimes have trouble scanning. He says that he never has trouble scanning when he uses his iPhone camera. I noticed that you can also rate movies on Pocketpedia, and that information syncs back to your Mac database. I feel like a dope that I didn't even notice that feature. Thanks to Hearn, and big apologies to Brugy for the omission. Well, if you've been listening to the show for any length of time, you're aware of my single biggest pet peeve, and that's the phrase, "so easy your mother could do it." I hear this all the time on tech shows, and it makes me crazy. People never say so easy your father could do it, so why single out a huge percentage of the population in this way? Is there something about childbirth that makes a person a tech idiot? Oddly, this idiocy does not apply to a childless woman, so there's that to noodle on, too. And by the way, it isn't just men that say this. I hear women say it all the time, and I don't understand it. Well, evidently, Scott Adams, the artist behind the Dilbert comic, has noticed this odd phrase as well. Thanks to both Tim in Florida and John Melanson for pointing me to his comic from August 5th, 2014. I've got it in the show notes, but I just want to read out the basics to you. The pointy-haired boss says, "The interface needs to be so simple that your mother could use it." And Dilbert replies, "My mother taught herself Ruby on Rails over a weekend." Pointy-haired boss responds with, "Then imagine someone else's mother." To which Dilbert simply says, "Can I imagine a sexist imbecile?" Anyway, thank you, Scott Adams. Now I can point to this comic every time I hear this obnoxious phrase. Well, I got a note and a recording from listener Tom Stewart that I want to read slash play to you. He wrote in his note, "Hi, Allison. With the Apple announcement that they're dropping development of Aperture, I thought the attached article might be of interest to your listeners. I moved to Lightroom about a year ago and needed to find a way to get the benefits of the Apple ecosystem while processing in Lightroom." Anyway, he sent that note and he also sent in an audio recording, so let's hear how he solved the problem.
Hello, Allison and those silly castaways. This is Tom Stewart from the northern side of the Great Lakes, with some information which may be of use to people who are thinking of moving over to Lightroom now that Aperture has been declared as no longer being updated. Up until a year ago, I was totally within the walled garden and enjoying the benefits of the Apple ecosystem and its integration. My Aperture libraries were always available to my Apple TVs and iPad. A slight editing change on one of my raw images within the Aperture library would be automatically reflected in the next slideshow on the Apple TV or when syncing my iPad. When I decided to make the switch to Lightroom, I had not realized the impact it would have on my workflows for sharing images. Learning Lightroom itself was easy. My problem to be solved was how to adapt having part of my media outside the Apple ecosystem. A second problem, although not directly related, was how to use online backup services to maintain backup copies of my better images. Because Lightroom does not store my images in a package file, unlike Aperture, I needed to create a folder structure which would be appropriate for my needs. I created a new folder called Working Library, and then as a vacation or family event occurred, I would create a new subfolder, copy the images from the SD card to the new folder, and then import them into the Lightroom catalog and begin my editing. When I come back from a photo trip, I often have several thousand raw images. Of these, about 75% I will discard at some point in my review and developing process, so I don't want to use bandwidth backing up all of these large files. Of those remaining, I try to find my favorite 100 or so, which become my slideshow for those friends who make the mistake of coming over and asking how my trip went. how to get it to the Apple TV. The easiest method is to make a slideshow in Lightroom and then use AirPlay to show it. But how to sync the images to my iPad? I tried various services and apps, but found shortcomings in the ones I tried. At this point, I realized I might be able to solve my two problems at the minor cost of using a little more hard drive space. I created a new folder on my hard drive called Keepers. I then created subfolders in a similar but not necessarily identical pattern to my working library. Once I have processed the images for an event or trip, I export my favorite edited image as high-quality JPEGs into the Keepers structure. I load these images into Aperture to get the important images into the walled garden for its various benefits and uses. As well, I include the Keepers folder and its subfolders in my online backup set. I realize that I have hundreds of raw images in my working library which don't get online backup, but in the very unlikely event that I lose my Lightroom library and all of my local backups, I will at least have the best images in high-quality JPEGs. For the few images which I have sold or feel are extra special, I have a folder in the Keepers section where I maintain a copy of the original RAW files. These then automatically get the online backup treatment, but I don't load them into Aperture. The biggest downside to this approach is that should I want to change an image in the Keepers library, I have to edit it in Lightroom, re-export it as a JPEG to the Keepers folder, and re-import it into Aperture. I will be interested to see what features are in Yosemite and the new Photos app for Mac, which might cause me to reevaluate and find a smoother workflow. But for now, this is working well. I hope one of these listeners will be able to use some of these ideas of my workflow to help them with theirs. Thanks a lot.
Hey, thank you so much, Tom. That was really cool. It's an interesting workaround. It's unfortunate that Apple has left us in a position where those kinds of workarounds are necessary, but it sounds like a good way to go at it. So thanks a lot for the submission. That was awesome. Well, speaking of photography, for years I've seen Apple come out with OS X updates to say new camera RAW support. And for years I've wondered what that really was and why does anyone care? I can tell you that I intimately understand why people care now, so I thought I'd share my newfound knowledge with you. Not that you'll necessarily ever care, but just so you too will have this vast understanding. So you know how with music you can have an uncompressed audio file on an old-fashioned CD, or you can compress it into an MP3 so you can get way more music onto an iPod? To make a song into an MP3, they remove sounds supposedly not heard by the human ear to make it significantly smaller. In photography, there's something similar. Photographs can be created in a camera either in their raw, uncompressed format or in the much smaller JPEG format. If you choose to have your camera take photos and keep them in JPEG, there is information removed that can never be recovered, just as with an MP3 compressed audio file. For the typical snap shooter, this is not a big deal, especially in a generation that thinks it's just fine to purposely crop a photo square and put a filter on it to make it look like it was taken in 1962. But I digress. If you tell your camera to keep the images in the RAW format, you'll be able to do more to enhance and improve your photos than if you store in JPEG. The best example, as discussed extensively on Bart's incredibly awesome show Let's Talk Photography over at let's-talk.ie, is when you take a photo and set the white balance incorrectly. If your camera thinks it's a normal sunny day, but you're taking photos indoors in fluorescent light, all of the colors will be wrong. If you had your camera compress the images into JPEGs, you can't do anything about it. But with a RAW photo, you can simply point at something that should be white or gray, and your image editor will correct all of the colors for you. Okay, now we know why you might want to care about RAW, but what are these RAW support updates all about? It turns out that the RAW format isn't just one format. It seems to be more of a guideline. Two cameras made by the same manufacturer within the same year will not have the same RAW format. That means that everyone who makes an image editor has to do an update to it every time a new RAW format is created. Now, I was corrected when I wrote this on the blog post, but my understanding was that Adobe's Lightroom, Acorn, Pixelmator, iPhoto, and Aperture all have to come out with these updates. But I think the correction said that they're all looking to Apple's to the OS to have that raw camera support. But I do know for sure that an image editor that George from Tulsa was talking about recently in our Google Plus community called Lyn, that's L-Y-N, kind of a cool little app I'm probably going to do a review of. Anyway, in Lyn, it definitely does not use the raw camera support from the OS because I was able to actually do some work on my photos before the update came out. But I'm getting ahead of myself. Anyway, since Aperture and iPhoto for sure are tied in so closely to the operating system, OS X itself has to be updated for these new RAW camera formats. And like I said, it might be true for some of the other applications. So I pretty much understood the story up to here a long time ago, but I didn't understand what the impact it that happens to the photographer. I bought the Olympus OMD E-M10 Micro Four Thirds camera just a few months after it came out. I blamed Steven Getz about it, as I've mentioned before. I took my first photos in RAW, plugged my camera's SD card into my Mac, and used the import feature to bring the .orf, that's Olympus's RAW format name, the .orf files into Aperture. When I clicked on any of the images, Aperture told me it couldn't read them. It said it was an unsupported format. That meant from the day I got my camera until new RAW support came out in the operating system, I would not be allowed to shoot RAW. I was very sad indeed. Distraught and realizing what had gone wrong, I went out on the Googles and learned that the RAW format for the EM10 was pretty similar to the other Olympus models, like the EM1. I found a discussion forum post to a script that modifies the EXIF, that's the camera data, to fool Aperture into thinking it was taken by an EM1, which Aperture does support. Now, I knew we had something to work with, but I have to describe to you what I had to do every time I took photos off my camera. I should mention that I tell my camera to shoot RAW, but I also keep a JPEG handy just in case I need it for something later. So, let's go through the process that I followed every time I took a photo. I'd plug the SD card into my Mac. Then I'd select the folder for the card in the Finder and use the Spotlight search box in the Finder to isolate only the .orf files. Because remember, I have JPEGs in there too, so I want to see just the .orf files. I'd open another tab in the Finder and navigate to a folder that I put on my desktop entitled Raw Photos for Import. Before dragging the ORFs into this folder, I have to clean out the glop I left in there from last time. Now, I leave the previous import in there so I can see the file number where I stopped last time. Remember, I can't look at these photos because I can't open them, so I only know that I stopped on 1279, so I have to start at 1280 on the new import. I don't clean off the card every time either. While remembering the number where I should start, back to the Filter to ORF Only tab for the memory card, I select just the newer images and drag them into that folder on my desktop. Then I launch the terminal. I issue the CD command to change directory and then drag the little Finder window icon. You know that thing is called a proxy icon that's at the top of every Finder window. I drag that onto the terminal so that I can execute the change directory command to that directory without having to type it. Next, I have to invoke the script. Once I did this about 12 times, I realized, why not create a text expander snippet for that? The command is exif tool space dash camera type 2 equals, quote, e-m1, unquote, star.orf. All right, now that folder in my desktop has two files for every image, the renamed .orf underscore original and a new and improved file with just .orf as the extension. All right, finally, I can now import from this directory into Aperture. I hope you can see how when Bob Correa posted to our Google Plus community that Apple had released a new RAW camera support update, I danced around the house like a crazy person because the EM10 was on that list. Thank you to many others like Steven Getz, the root of the cause of all this new camera nonsense, who sent me tweets about the update as well. Now you know at least why I care so deeply about RAW camera updates, or at least that RAW camera update. If you're looking for the silver bullet that will make you instantly productive, then you should just move along right now. But if you've tried a lot of different apps to manage the various projects you have in your life and none have really managed to click with the way you think, then Daymap from WhetstoneApps.com might be the app to help you get moving on that ever-growing task list of yours. I got an email from Todd Cothran about why he invented Daymap. He said, Daymap came about because I couldn't find a digital version of a personal productivity app that worked the way I think. I like to see everything at a glance, and I couldn't find anything that was set up in that way. He wanted an app that would visually map out what he had to get done for each project he had going on in his life. He teamed up with a programmer and a designer to create Daymap for OS X and iPhone. I took a look at the screenshots on the Mac App Store, and I immediately saw how different Daymap is from normal project planning software. First of all, think of projects as logical groupings of what you have to get done, not necessarily giant projects. When I start looking at Daymap, I realize that the projects to me would be things like reviews for the show, website tasks, home stuff, screencast online tasks, and my daughter's wedding and shower. Your projects would likely be completely different. It might include projects for work or home or church or anything you want to pile together. I mentioned at the beginning that Daymap is visual. The top half of the window has a column for each of your projects, with each column brightly colored so they stand out. You can set the colors yourself, but I found the ones it automatically chose were perfectly good to help make the different columns be distinct. Under those colorful column headings, there's a plus sign. Tap it to add a new task. One of the basic tenets of the getting things done theory is to break down tasks into each of the constituent tasks to make them less overwhelming. Under reviews, I put review Daymap. That's kind of overwhelming as a single task, so I created subtasks using a keystroke to break it down to install on OS X, install on iOS, watch video tutorials, play with it, take notes, and finally write a review. It's more fun when you create subtasks because you really feel like you're getting things done when you can check them off quickly. That feeling of accomplishment helps you keep your momentum going. Daymap is equally useful to those who like to point and click with the mouse and those who love a keystroke. For example, I can tap on a task and hit the space bar to complete it, and it turns gray and gets a line through it. I could also select a task, then go to the task menu with my mouse and select complete and get the same result. I think as you get better with Daymap, you'll find the keystrokes to be a great boon to getting the tool out of your way and actually accomplishing your tasks. I've talked a lot about the top half of the window with your projects and all their tasks. The bottom half of the window is a calendar view. If you're good at assigning tasks to specific due dates, you'll love this. Simply drag a task from its project column onto the calendar to set its due date. As soon as you do that, the task in the project list above becomes italicized in the project view so you'll know it has a due date. Like everything else in Daymap, there's a second way to do it. You can assign due dates by double-clicking the task and using a calendar picker from the open window. You can also have repeated tasks, too. The calendar view on the bottom is very flexible. You can view a week or a month, scroll to move around, or use keystrokes to move around. You can choose to view your Apple Calendar events, too, which really helps to make sure you're not assigning tasks to when you already have a busy day planned. Daymap politely asks you when you first open it whether it can have permission to view your calendar, so if you don't want this feature, it's not forced upon you. Personally, I'm not good at all at assigning dates to tasks. I like to keep a task list, but perhaps I'm not as accountable to times as some more structured folks. If I have to get something done by a certain date, I'll do it. But like I said, I'm more of a hippie about the timing if it truly doesn't have a constraint. For example, it was Thursday when I wrote this, but I could have written it on Sunday, and it would have been almost as good. I bring this up because I like that Daymap allows you to hide the calendar view if you don't want to see it, using the view menu or a keystroke to toggle the view on and off. Back to the project outline view on the top. You get those little hamburger icons in every project name heading, which allow you to drag the projects to reorder them. You can also change the width of the columns easily, and with an option click on a project, all of the other projects collapse. They become tight vertical columns with just their project name showing. A simple task on any of the other hamburger icons, and their projects come back into full view. I like to be able to focus on one subject at a time, cuts down on that ADD problem, so this works really well for me. I love the drag-and-drop features of Daymap. Like I said, you can drag a task to the calendar, but you can also drag a task to a different project, and you can drag tasks to make them subtasks. I mentioned that hitting the spacebar shows a task is complete, but what happens to those completed tasks? I personally like to see a big list of completed items so I can feel good about my productivity, but after a while, that's going to get pretty cluttered, right? In the upper right of the window, you get a slider that allows you to choose when to hide completed tasks, anywhere from immediately to never, with 0 to 90 days of granularity in between. So maybe you want to see everything you got done in the last week. You can do that. How often are you working on one thing when you suddenly remember something you need to do on a totally different subject? If you drop what you're doing to write it down somewhere, you lose track of what you were doing and easily get sucked into the wormhole of the other task. With Daymap, you can assign a keystroke that enters a task into a project entitled Inbox. As long as Daymap is running in the background, it will drop the task into the inbox where you can drag it to the right project later when you're not trying to focus. It does move Daymap to the front window, but it's easy enough to command tab back to what you were doing. It would be even cooler if there was a Daymap helper menu bar app that could collect your tasks with a little less interruption, but this is pretty useful as it is. Now, I could go on and on with what I learned to do in Daymap, but Todd has four great videos showing off how to use Daymap that really helped me to hit the ground running with it. So I'll let you learn more on your own, and of course, there's a link to that in the show notes. All of this is well and good, but how well does Daymap support the Road Warrior on iOS? I have to say that while there is an iOS app, it's designed for iPhone only. The beautiful layout of Daymap cries out for an iPad app. With the iPhone app, they had to abandon the visual element they went to so much work to produce for the OS X app. The iPhone app works fine for what it is, don't get me wrong. And my favorite part is how it seamlessly syncs through iCloud between OS X and iOS. I can't say it was instantaneous, but I was unable to measure how long it took for each side to update when I changed it on OS X versus iOS and back. It was that fast. I can clearly see my projects in list form, and by tapping on each one, I can see a view with my tasks completed and uncompleted. I can easily tap to show a task is complete. The interface is clean and uncluttered and gives you the mobile interface you need to add new tasks and subtasks. While I was on my daily walk, I remembered something I needed to do. I opened Daymap, opened the right project, tapped enter a new task, and used my iPhone headphones to dictate the task. It took me maybe 15 seconds to record that task and continue on my walk. When I got home, sure enough, it was on my Mac's version of Daymap. Now, I did contact Todd, and he assured me that they're working on an iPad version of Daymap that will take advantage of the real estate and bring the beautiful interface that you get in OS X over to the iPad. They're also working on improvements to the iPhone app to bring more of the OS X style to iOS. Daymap is available from whetstoneapps.com, and there you'll find links to it in the Mac App Store version, which is $9.99, and the iPhone version for only 99 cents. You can download a free trial of the Mac version at Whetstone Apps and give it a spin to find out if it works for you. I have to say that after using it for some real work this week, Daymap represents my task for me visually in a way that really makes sense. I like that Todd designed an application that scratched his own itch and then made it available for all of the rest of us. I've really been enjoying all the great feedback from people telling me how much they're loving the newly released Clarify 2 from clarify-it.com. People are really coming out of the woodwork on this one. Some people are sending along, thanks, great update, and others are sending me tutorials, which is even more fun. Last week, when I talked about why Steve and I are still buying physical DVDs, I mentioned that I ran into the dreaded 5-computer limit in iTunes. I couldn't even account for why Apple thought I had 5 authorized. Donald Burr wrote on the blog about how once a year, Apple will allow you to reauthorize all of your computers. Isn't that big of them? Anyway, I knew you could do that because I've had to do it before, but Donald also pointed out that anytime you do a nuke and pave, you probably forget to deauthorize. Well, I had no idea Apple considered that a second authorization, and you know I'm a fan of the nuke and pave, so I'm sure that Donald has cracked the code on why Apple thinks I have 5, but I wasn't able to count that many. Donald took it a step further, though. He created a Clarify 2 document walking us through exactly how to reset your iTunes activations. Of course, there's a link in the show notes to his tutorial on clarify-it.com, which, of course, he accomplished by simply clicking a button. If you haven't jumped on the special offers for Clarify 2, get started quickly. The 50% off sale on the App Store expires on August 11th, so I hope you're hearing this before then. If you missed it and you'd like the non-App Store version anyway, or maybe the cross-platform version, you can still get 25% off with the special code just for Nocilla Castaways. Get your pen ready. It's Nocilla-C2 in all capital letters. Now, that is not typed into the show notes, so write it down now, Nocilla-C2, all capital letters. And that one expires on September 1st, so you still have a little bit of time. Check to make sure you don't qualify for a free upgrade first, though. There's lots of ways you might qualify, so go check that out at clarify-it.com. Now I've got to run off and follow Donald's instructions and reauthorize all of my Macs from iTunes. Well, it's that time of the week again. It's time for Chit Chat Across the Pond, and I have a well-known voice to the Nocilla Castaways here. I have Alistair Jenks, also known as Zedcarge or Zcarge on Twitter. Welcome to the show again.
Great to be here. Thank you, Allison.
All right. Well, if you guys have been paying attention, you'll recognize that voice as the man who, one of the people who takes over when I'm a slacker on vacation and keeps the show coming out. And obviously a huge contributor to the show over the years. And I wanted to get Alistair on because he's gone through an interesting journey from becoming a programmer early on and his journey to become an iOS developer. Now, this isn't going to be a propeller beanie show, I don't think. I don't think we're going to be talking about squirrely brackets and syntax, but I think more the journey that you went on to get there, right, Alistair?
Yeah, it's the experiences and what surprised me about getting into this particular practice.
Okay, cool, cool. So how far back do you go in programming? And I'm not going to ask you how old you are, just, you know, I know people are sensitive about their age, but how far back do you go in programming?
You know, I thought about that age question, and hey, I wear my age on my sleeve. I started when I was 12, and of course anybody who can look up this technology, and I'm going to give you links, can figure out how old I am. My father brought a Dick Smith System 80 into the house. He had some ideas of what he wanted to do with it. And he and I just sort of, you know, got into it, geeked out, and started figuring out what this thing could do. So that was my introduction to programming. Back in the days when graphics was, I think it was 128 pixels by 48 on the screen, black or white.
I like it, I like it. And that was graphics, though, not just text.
Well, barely. The graphics were actually text in disguise, to be honest, on that.
Okay. I haven't even heard of a Dick Smith Micro. Systems, I mean.
Yeah, it was an Australian version of the TRS-80, which you may well have heard of. Yeah.
Yeah. I never touched one myself, but definitely heard of it. So you started at a very early age. Your dad got you into programming, right?
Yeah. I guess he just sort of, you know, let me loose on this thing, and he and I started working on problems that he was trying to solve, and I sort of learned through that.
Very cool. To all the parents out there, just sit your kids in front of this stuff, and sometimes amazing things happen, right?
Exactly.
Get them interested. So where'd you go from there?
We did quite a few things there. He has been an editor of various publications over the years, and we worked on, you know, gathering text files and doing stuff with them. My favorite one ever, I think, was working out how to take a text file and send it over a serial port to an Olivetti electronic typewriter and fully justify the text as it was output.
Wow. Downtown.
It was so much fun. Yeah, I absolutely loved it. So that sort of really got my my juices flowing in terms of there was an end goal, a problem to be solved, as you like to say. So that's where I've done my best work. And from there, the next computer that came into the household was my brother's. Notice I haven't paid anything myself yet. And that was a BBC Micro. And that was a British computer that was actually partially designed for education purposes. So programming was a big part of that. And I guess that's where I really sort of cut my teeth on programming and got the bug properly.
I see. Now, are you like me in that it only gets interesting when it doesn't work at first?
I do like to play around with things and just, you know, see what it can do and have fun. But yeah, the real wins are when stuff doesn't do what it's supposed to or what you want it to, and you do have to figure out the hard bits and make it behave. That's, you know, I pretty much do that for a living these days, make things do what they should.
I like that. I like that. I remember back to when I was early in using the web at all, and it was always really hard to get things to work, you know, and it was really, really interesting. And then we left. Oh, I can't remember who our first ISP was. It was one of the classics. You'd know it if I said it. But anyway, then we went to AT&T, and I was so excited because I was like, wow, this is going to be awesome. This is going to be so much fun because this isn't going to work at all. I'm going to have hours of entertainment. And I stuck the CD in, and I double-clicked it, and I was connected. Like, oh, man, so fun at all. Or like the time when we got a new Mac, and Steve and I were fighting over who was going to set it up. Yeah, you know, as most couples do. And Steve, we agreed on a truce that he could put the hardware together and I would install the operating system. I was like, okay, that's fair. And so he sets it up and we turned it on and the OS was already there.
Pre-installed and running.
I'm still mad about that. But anyway, so back to your progress here.
Yeah, so having got into this, as I say, from age 12 and through my teen years, my mother told me that my eyesight would go if I sat in front of that screen for too long. She was half right. I have excellent vision, but I'm really sensitive to bright lights, so I'll give her that one.
I got news for you. Your eyes go either way. So
yeah, I know. So I finished my school. I did actually start going to university, but I just found that wasn't for me. And, you know, even though I was taking computer science at uni and quite enjoying it, it was all the rest of the stuff that I wasn't. And I was having lunch with a school friend and said I was looking for a job. And he said, "Do you want mine?" I said, "Okay." And I became a trainee programmer.
Wait, how old were you at this professional
point? I would have been 18 at that stage.
Oh, okay. So you have no training in training people, but you knew what to teach them?
Well, no, trainee programmer was the title. So I was the trainee.
Got you.
But I got it on. I got the job largely on the strength of my then hobby. So, yeah, that's where it started as a career. And I wouldn't call myself a programmer or a developer in my job at the moment, but I do a fair bit of that, usually working on tools that will help us automate stuff for the most part.
But without the formal training of a university education, you're saying?
Correct. I mean, I did the first, I think it was the first half-year course, but I already knew all that stuff from just being a geek at home. So, there hasn't really been any formal training. It's more just been me trying to make stuff work, as you said earlier on.
Right, right. I think we've argued about this before, about whether or not you need a university education. So we won't go over that again.
It depends who you are, I think, is the answer to that.
Some of the best, smartest people I know didn't go to college. So, all right. So now you're moving on from that job.
Yeah. Through my work, I've learned a lot of different technologies and learned how to translate between different technologies, because you learn one thing and then somebody else comes along and talks about something completely different. But what you'll find in computers is that mostly it's the same under the covers. It's still the same bits being pushed around on the electronics. And if you know where to look, you can actually find all the similarities. So, you know, I learnt BASIC on the Dick Smith and the BBC, and I switched to a language called RPG at work, which is one of those languages that nobody's ever heard of. And there's a good reason for that, because it's actually very, what's the word I'm looking for?
Arcane?
Yes, definitely arcane. The word I was looking for was rare. It only runs on one platform.
Oh, okay.
But again, you're still doing the same basic things.
So if I were to make any recommendation on someone hiring a programmer, if you're not a programmer yourself and you want to figure out whether you're hiring the right person, is the question isn't to ask, do you know C? Do you know C++? Do you know C#? Whatever. Do you know BASIC? What do you know? The question is, how do you feel when a programming language gets swapped out from under you? And if the person says,
yes.
Oh, yeah, it's really fun. It's really interesting. Look at the differences. And I check out the syntax and I find that so much of it's the same, but I got to learn this, that, and the other thing. You hire that person.
That would be exactly the right thing to do, in my view. Knowing the particular language that your role requires will be an advantage. But knowing the underpinnings.
If you don't like it, it's a disadvantage the next day when it changes, because it is going to change.
I wouldn't say it changes as much as you might imagine, but it does change.
Well, not all the time. No, certainly not. I'm not meaning to imply that, but everything changes. And if you've got somebody who doesn't like that change or hates that kind of change,
yes,
then you got yourself your COBOL programmer there who's helpful during the Y2K and OJ. That's about it.
Well, yeah, I mean, we are fans of Apple, who now are changing things once a year on both the platforms that we like. So
exactly.
We have to get used to it.
Exactly.
So, yeah, it's the hobby and the career have sort of run in parallel for many, many years now. And I do find that having it both at work and at home, you know, some people say, "Oh my God, you do that all day at work and then you go home and do it as well." And it's like, well, yeah. And indeed, I took a couple of weeks off in the middle of the year to really sort of crack into this development.
Hmm.
And my team leader says, "You're crazy. You're going to go home and do what looks like work." And I just said to him, "This to me is like fishing to you." Which he then immediately got and said, "Enjoy your 2 weeks off."
Okay. I have known one highly technical, really great system administrator who very not that long ago, maybe 5 or 6 years ago, didn't have the internet at home because she didn't want it.
Wow!
But other than that, I think she was definitely an oddity. If you love this stuff, it's fun, right?
It is. It's what makes my my life tick over, as far as I'm concerned. Yeah. If I'm not doing this, I'm sort of getting withdrawal symptoms, to be honest.
Yep. Okay. All right. So now, next, you were going to start talking about what the different programming types are, right?
Yeah, because this is a big part of where my journey has gone over the years, and specifically with iOS development, the big hurdle that I had to get over. So when I learned programming, it was what I would call pure programming. And what I've done is I've come up with my sort of classification of different levels of programming. Now, with Taming the Terminal, you've done what I would call pure programming, where you're concentrating on the specifics of, you know, like a shell script, for example, or, you know, even regular expressions, and trying to figure out exactly what each piece does. And Bart has been coming up with somewhat contrived examples to you know, explain how it works. And that, to me, is pure programming. It's basic computation, and you're not really concerned about making it look pretty or anything. It's just really at the bowels of programming.
Right.
And there's kind of another level above that, which is where Bart gets to at the end of each session, where he says, well, let's solve a real problem. But you're still not really paying any attention to presentation or anything like that. It's just, okay, we know the basics. We're now going to attack a certain problem and use those basics to actually give us an answer to a question we really actually want to know.
Right.
So that sort of programming is, I would say, actually relatively easy to pick up and learn. I mean, you can choose the right language, and you can do a lot of theoretical stuff and even solve some real problems, but you don't have to worry about too much of the complexity. Next level is what I would call full programming, which probably doesn't exist anymore, but I certainly went through, and that was where many years ago, I wrote various applications. I wrote one to catalog my collection of 35 millimeter slides. Now, in that case, I wrote a complete user interface that was based on, I don't know if you've heard of Teletext, which was the system, I think they called it CFAX in the UK, and it was actually a text-based system that came over the TV transmission and came, you know, brought up a set of information. It was also big in France, except I forget what they called it.
I think I heard about that, about the version in France, but they may have had it here. I just was unaware.
Yeah. So anyway, the BBC Micro that my brother had the ability to display this stuff, and what it gave you was a simple text-based interface that had some nice color. And so I built up a complete user interface, you know, with sort of, you know, use the keyboard to move highlights around text to select things and that kind of stuff. So that's what I call it. You know, it's a full application, but you were in complete control of all the visual aspects as well as all the you know, goings on under the hood.
Okay.
And then you move on to the bit where, as a hobbyist, I got left behind, to be honest, for many years. And that is what I would call system programming. Now, system programming is where you are working with a platform, and it provides a GUI, for example. And the first GUIs were coming out even when I was programming on the BBC Micro. And now, all of a sudden, you have to know how to, say, put a window on the screen. You know, you just want to, you know, draw a smiley face. Well, to draw a smiley face, you need to put a window on the screen. You need to give it a title. You need to know how big it is. You need to know how to draw in this window rather than just, you know, plotting something in the middle of the screen.
So just having the math right isn't going to help you. You've got to actually make it where someone can see what you're doing.
Yeah, and okay. It means you have to follow all the conventions that this system provides. So the early windowing environments, I mean, in fact, I had one on the BBC Micro, which was, I think, a direct response to the Mac when it came out. And it started getting complex. You know, you had to figure out how to put something on the screen so that you could then do what you wanted to do. And iOS is very much like that, in the sense that, you know, you've got the iOS screen. You don't just start drawing on it. Well, you can just start drawing on the screen, but even to do that, there's some stuff you have to do beforehand to say, I'm an application, I've launched, and, you know, various little bits and pieces that you just have to do, otherwise things aren't going to happen. And then iOS actually goes to the next level, which is full-on system programming where you not only have to deal with the GUI, but you also have to deal with all the other bits and pieces. Like if I want to store a piece of information, I can't just put a file somewhere on the disk and put my information in it. With iOS, I don't have that ability. So I have to learn, okay, iOS, how do I actually store some information so that when the user quits the app and comes back, it's still there?
Because you don't have access to the file system.
Yeah. So it's not only the GUI, but also all sorts of other things and how this whole system fits together. And on the one hand, that makes it easy to write a very simple app. If you want to write a shopping list app, it's actually, you know, remarkably quick because the operating system provides so many capabilities for you to do that.
Okay. Because
on the other hand,
you know, those kind of buttons already exist and frames and things like that.
And lists and checkboxes and things like that.
Okay.
But on the other hand, you then have to learn how to get and control and display all of these things. I mean, the displaying's mostly done for you, but okay, how do I get a list? How do I add items to the list?
Mm-hmm.
How do I respond when the user touches an item on the list? How do I slide that to another view to show the detail? Or all those sorts of things. So you have
Which
a lot
maybe
of...
Maybe isn't hard, but it's very different, is what your point is, right?
It's different, but it's also it's the sheer number of these things that you have to deal with.
Okay.
Because just about anything you need to do, you'll need to find the right API to do it.
Okay, and API stands for Application Programming Interface?
It does. And it's Application Program Interface.
Okay.
And it's basically just, this is where you can basically tell the operating system, hey, do this please.
Okay.
And it will go and do it for you.
The hooks to get into that.
Yeah.
Right, okay.
That's exactly it. So that's the complexity. You know, if you start with learning to program, you will start at the bottom end of just, you know, figuring out how to swap out some characters in a sentence or a word,
mm-hmm.
or, you know, adding some numbers or working out the square root of something. But then at the other end, which is where you'll go with iOS, I actually leave that detail stuff to the end because that's the most fun for me, and I get all the huge numbers of APIs and everything sorted out up front.
Oh, interesting. I think I would probably go the other way around. You know, drawing it and putting the cute little buttons together would be the fun part. And it's like, oh, now I got to figure out what it's going to do.
the app I'm working on at the moment is to do with photography, huh? And involves the triad. You know, the ISO, uh-huh. Well, not the ISO. The aperture, the focal length, and the focus distance.
Okay.
And I had all the maths worked out for that well before I started, and then I made myself build the interface. And that took so long. And then when I finally got it to the point, I thought, yay. And I can now do the fun part, which was working out how to actually, you know, move around those numbers and get what I want out of them.
Mm-hmm.
So it was, it took me quite a long time to get to the point where I could actually start drawing on the screen.
All right. Okay. So from there.
So getting started in iOS programming is actually really simple and free. And I'll take you through the method that I use. Now, bearing in mind the background that I've just given you of you know, the fact that I am a programmer of sorts, but that I had to learn a lot of the concepts that come with iOS programming that were new to me. First thing you do, get Xcode. It's on the App Store. There's a link in the show notes for that. And it's free. It's a very big download. A friend of mine tweeted just earlier today that it took him longer to copy it out of the image file to his applications folder than it did to download it.
Wait,
like
does that mean his computer is slower than his internet access?
Yeah.
The bus on his computer? That's...
I pointed that out, but he has a fast internet connection and a spinning hard drive.
Oh. So he's got like 5,400 RPM drive, but great internet?
I think he claimed it was 72. But yeah, it's like 5 or 6 gigabytes.
Yeah.
But you know, Xcode is actually all you need to get started. And it's a big, massive program that does all sorts of things. It's kind of like Photoshop in the sense that you'll probably never learn everything it can do,
mm-hmm.
but it can do everything you will ever need. So it's free. Just download it and open it up and you'll take one look at it and think, what on earth do I do with this? And this is where the learning comes in. And the way I did it was with tutorials.
Hmm.
Now, I started off with a book that was recommended by a friend who's also been through this journey recently, which was called Become an Xcoder Now that, just consult my notes here. In fact, my browser is by somebody called Bert Altenberg. So there'll be a link in the show notes to that book. Now I went through that, and that went through a lot of the basics of Objective-C, which until recently was the language that you used to develop for iOS, and it's the one I'm still using.
It doesn't change very fast at all, Alistair.
No. And I found that book really good for getting through the basics of Objective-C. So that was me translating from my existing programming knowledge. So I know what a variable is. I know what a loop is. I know what a conditional is. How do you do that in Objective-C? And what are the idiosyncrasies of this particular language? However, I think it dates from 2006 or something. So
the book does?
Yeah. So after it goes through the basics, it says, right, now open up Xcode. And I got to that point and I opened up Xcode and it said, click this. And it's, where is that? And Xcode had moved on quite considerably.
Yeah. From the stuff that I was trying to learn from, it was, if you were a half a rev behind, it was unrecognizable.
Yeah. And especially with the latest releases, you know, once the iOS 8 related stuff comes out, it changes massively again. So,
right.
But change is fun. It is fun. And the first part of that book about learning Objective-C, Objective-C is still on the table, and I think it's worth going through that at this stage.
I don't want to learn it.
It's fun.
No, I had a lot of trouble with the book. I started with a book that was recommended by my buddy Niraj, this guy I met him at a conference. I can't remember what the name of the book was because I actually wouldn't recommend it. And, man, I had a terrible time following it. It didn't stick in my brain the way that guy taught it, at least.
Yeah. I've had the same experience with some tutorials, just didn't make sense to me. And I think I've tried some other books as well, and it was just too much, or, you know, went too deep for me, mm-hmm. or didn't go deep enough. Right. And you know, as all things, my father has a saying which I've lived by for many, many years, that he says, road signs are put up by people who know where they're going. And it takes a lot of people a while to figure out what that means, but yeah, when you write about something in terms of documenting it for somebody else to learn or even just to do, the hardest thing is to not gloss over stuff that you just take for granted.
Right, because you already know it. Why would you need to tell anybody?
So I find that some of the books and tutorials suffer from that, and it's like, okay, but you know, you said, oh, just click this, but you didn't say where this actually was, and I don't see it on the screen.
I hate that when they say to click it. It's like, oh, well, you didn't know you had to open up this side panel?
Yeah.
Well, why didn't you tell me there was a side panel to open? I didn't know it was there.
Exactly, you know, that.
One of the things I used to do, though, I was really proud of myself. I had a job where I had to explain fairly complex stuff to people, and I had an administrative assistant, a secretary, if you will, who was really, really smart but not technical at all, didn't have much background, but she was brilliant. And so I would just try to teach her the concept, and I knew that if I could explain it to her, that meant I was using language that a normal person could follow, and that therefore I'd be able to communicate it successfully to the audience that I really did need to reach. And it's great if you can find somebody like that who's willing to learn but has no background, then you're not doing the street sign problem.
Yeah. In fact, at work many years ago, I was writing documentation, and we had a team of, I think it was 9 people other than me. And I wrote this documentation on a task that would take me 5 minutes. Mm-hmm. And then I gave it to another team member and said, try this out and tell me if there's any problems. I gave it to the 9th team member in a row, and they still found one problem with it. So it went through my entire team, and every single member of the team found something wrong with the documentation.
It hadn't been explained properly. Interesting. Yep. Interesting.
That'd have worked well after that.
Yeah, I bet it did.
Now, moving on then, the tutorial that really kicked it off for me, there's a website called Code with Chris.
Hmm.
And he had a 5-part tutorial on just building an app. Now, if I remember correctly, it was the dice rolling app. So,
Okay.
I just found his style very simple. He didn't really gloss over much. I mean, you don't end up doing much, but he covers all the key things that you need in these 5 parts. Yeah, it starts off with concepts, how to make iPhone apps, and he gets into object-oriented programming and classes, which is all sort of before you even, you know, fire up the iPhone-related stuff.
Right.
And, you know, he explains model view controller, which I'll mention a bit further on as well, which is a very important thing to understand and a very difficult thing to understand. And I found his explanation was very functional and helped, you know, secure it in my mind. So with the help of that tutorial, I ended up with a running application that I had done myself, you know, and I made myself type it and I didn't copy and paste anything and I made the mistakes. And because I already had a developer account, which I'll mention in a moment, I was able to run it on my phone. And, oh boy, the buzz you get from doing that is makes it all worth it. And that's when you realize that, hey, I can do this. So, you know, I had this largely useless dice rolling app on my phone, but, hey, I made it and I put it there.
Wrote it all by myself. Or typed it, at least. You know, that's so, something I do with Bart, and it drives him crazy because when he's doing Taming the Terminal, he's given me all the commands just to copy and paste in, but I refuse to do it. So I'm always, because I type them in myself because I want to know, I want to try to understand it a little more than just copy paste. But invariably, I get typos in it, and so that takes us, you know, 8 more minutes of explanation to try to figure out what I screwed up. So.
I find that very entertaining.
When I'm stuck.
Listening to Bart suddenly rewinding, oh, hang on a minute.
Every once in a while, I'm right that there was a mistake, but
yes.
9 times out of 10.
So, yes, tutorials and finding one that fits with the way you think may be a big part of it. That Code with Chris one, just for me, just ticked all the boxes. It was just the right level for me. He actually took you through a working example, which you're able to get running. And the thing is with Xcode, you know, if you download Xcode for free, you can run it in an iPhone simulator on your Mac. So you can go from go to woe for nothing. If you want to run it on your device, then you need to pay some monies to Apple. There are also various books, and I know we've kind of covered, I mean, Become an Xcoder was a book, but it was an ebook, so I kind of put that under tutorials. But there's, you know, what's that? Is it the Texan one, Big Nerd Code Ranch or something?
Yeah, I've heard of that.
That I think Kirshen Sia has mentioned those in the past, and they're pretty good as well. I got one of those and got stuck in it. I found it the wrong level for me, but that doesn't mean it's necessarily the wrong level for everybody. The biggest resources for information on learning this stuff, Google, honestly.
Really?
And about 80% of what will come up on Google once you get into the weeds of this stuff will be from a site called Stack Overflow.
I've seen that quite a few times in a lot of different things I'm looking for. I'm kind of surprised. It seems to be really taking off more than ever.
It is huge, and there are a lot of very, very smart people on there. I'll put a link in the show notes that is listing stuff tagged with iOS. And just scrolling through that list at the moment, how do I get a list of Facebook friends for my iOS app?
Oh, wow. And somebody just gives you tells you what to put in?
How have multiple instances of a class point to one object property, which, I mean, that'll be mumbo-jumbo to most people.
Yep.
Game center leaderboard, not dismissing. So these are all very, very detailed problems that people are having and that they're asking for help, and you tend to get very, very detailed answers, you know, code snippets and do this, and sometimes you'll get multiple answers to the same question, and it's just a really, really great technical resource.
From what I've read, they're not snarky there. You know, certain message boards tend to have a personality, and from what I've seen of the few times I've had to go to Stack Overflow for something else, I found that they were, you know, helpful and not snotty.
Yeah, they have a reputation system, which I think helps a lot with that.
Oh, okay.
But yes, you're right. I've found very, very helpful answers, and a lot of people will go out of their way to, instead of just saying, do this, they'll say because, and they'll explain it all. And you actually learn a lot more from those than just from copy-pasting.
Yeah, I like
so
that.
So Stack Overflow is king. And yeah, as I said before, most of it, if you do a Google search for the problem, you'll probably find Stack Overflow results on the first page almost every time.
Right.
So once you get into Xcode and you start solving all your problems with Stack Overflow, you might start thinking, I might be able to make something of this and at the very least want to run it on your own iPhone. I know people who've written apps for themselves. So they just write the app, stick it on their iPhone and use it, and it never goes anywhere. I've actually got an idea for a couple of those myself. So to run it on your device, you need to sign up to Apple's developer program. Now, it's $99 a year, and that gives you it makes you known to Apple. And because of that, you can run stuff on your device, because they basically don't want you installing stuff on any device unless you're known to them. You can distribute the apps.
That doesn't make you a signed developer, does it?
It does, yes. You end up using you can put it on your own devices relatively easily, but it does still involve certificates and stuff like that.
Okay. But I'm thinking about the – I guess we're talking about iOS, so signed developer is a little different than it means to the Mac.
Yeah, but it is signed in that sense.
Okay.
Because it has to be to go on an iPhone or an iPad. You can distribute it. So, for example, for my app, my first app, my very simple little app, I had, I think, three beta testers.
Mm-hmm.
And for this next one, I've got two of the same and another one, and I'll probably add more people, maybe even some
Beta
castaways.
Test. I love a beta test. Nobody finds bugs faster than me. Nobody. I'm telling you, I can kill anything.
I work with a guy, that's his specialty.
Yeah.
I code something, he breaks it.
It's so much fun when you find him. When I was pregnant with Lindsay, I was working on some high-end CAD software, and they were coming out with a new version, and I begged him to let me bring a computer home so that I could – actually, it was a terminal. It was a Tektronix 4107 terminal. I begged him to let me bring it home so I could test the new software. And even on a 9600 baud modem, how fast that CAD program was loading over that, I found a major bug within the first hour and a half I played with it. So I'm a fan.
Yeah, it's. I've seen feedback from Marco Arment on his Overcast podcast client, and he has been singing the praises of his beta testers because they found all sorts of really, really nasty bugs before it went out into the wild.
Yeah.
So it's definitely worth doing.
I'll tell you how not to do it. Where I used to work, they would send you a list of what to test. Well, list of what to test, then you already know that stuff works. Right?
Not necessarily in my experience.
Okay.
Apple actually do that with their betas of the operating systems as well. They say, please focus on these areas.
Well, sure. But no, this would say, click here, click there, type this, type that. Did it work? No. And I would refuse to do it. They'd get all mad at me, and I'd be over here just flinging around, clicking stuff they didn't think I would click, and I'd find all kinds of mistakes.
Yeah, no, that's not the right way to do it.
They didn't like me very much, but I found lots of bugs. So,
Once you paid your $99 per year, you can run it on your device, you can distribute it, and that process is not fun, but it's about to get a whole lot easier with iOS 8. You can sell it.
Wait, which part isn't fun? Selling it?
The distributing it.
Oh, how is that going to get easier?
Because Apple announced at WWDC that beta testing was going to go through the App Store and be based on iCloud ID. Currently, it's not through the App Store, and it's based on device IDs.
Right. And then didn't they also buy
Test Flight,
right, which is one of the easiest ways to set up people for beta testing?
Yeah, Test Flight was a third-party service that sought to solve this problem of distribution.
Right, right.
And it still wasn't, you know, point-and-click easy, but it was a heck of a lot easier than it had been.
It had been easier. I turned a couple of developers on who asked me to beta test, and they were telling me, here's how you get your EMEI number, and I said, no, don't do that. Here, sign up for this thing. And like 10 minutes later, they sent me a Test Flight. So it had to have been pretty easy.
You still have to get a few ducks in the line to get things to work through it, but it's certainly a lot easier than it was. But Apple are about to make it supremely easy.
Oh, good!
In that, I think it's just going to be, give me your iCloud ID and I'll add you to my list of people. That end.
Cool.
So you can sell, and you can get access to betas of operating systems. Now, I was fully expecting to get the beta of iOS 8, and I have actually briefly tried it on my iPad mini. And for iOS 7, I actually ran the betas from, I think it was beta 5 and 6 were pretty solid, and I ran that on my iPhone full time. So you get to have a bit of a play with that. And I was surprised this time to find that I can also get the beta of Yosemite.
Right.
Before, even though I'm only signed
everybody
up
can,
iPhone development.
Now everybody can, but for a while there, only the developers who'd paid their $100 could get it, right?
Yes, well, and it's the first million on the public program. So
you know, they made that sound like that was going to be a problem. I signed up yesterday and got it.
Oh, wow.
So either they haven't hit a million or they lied about it being only a million.
Or there's a whole lot of people who signed up to the developer program just so they could get the betas.
Maybe.
Which I know used to happen.
But wouldn't you have thought that there'd be more than a million by now? I mean, I just assumed I wouldn't get to do it because I just didn't get around to it for so long, but...
The phrase that comes to mind that I've heard other people use is, in our bubble, we might think that everybody wants to do this, but our bubble's actually not that big.
Shut up. Yes, it is.
So once you've signed up for the $99 a year, you can do anything. You are a fully-fledged Apple developer at that point.
Cool.
So the next step, I've labeled getting beyond playing, because you know, I signed up for a developer account and said, I'm going to do something with this, and I downloaded the beta of iOS 7, and that's pretty much all I did with it for about 6 months. And then I thought, you know what? I've put some money into this. I better do something with it. And that's when I started looking for the tutorials, etc. And I know... and I've known this for many years, but you keep reinforcing it pretty much every week. Find a problem to be solved before you look for any answers. So I had, over the last couple of years, as I was thinking about getting into this, put down a list of, you know, here's a bunch of apps that I would like to be able to build and use. And
I wish they existed, right?
Yeah. And you know, the first one that I built was an annoying little problem that my telco provider / ISP provide nice little usage charts because, you know, we have data caps here and, you know, number of minutes and number of texts in many cases. And they provide these nice little graphs or progress bars that show you how much of your allocation you have used. Mm-hmm. So it says, you know, you've used X number of text messages out of your total. And so I can see that I've used just over half, for example. And then at the top of the page, it says, oh, and this renews on the 26th of August. Okay, hang on. What's the date today? Oh, it's the 10th. So if it's the 10th and it's on the 26th, am I halfway through my month yet? Mental gymnastics, you know, to figure out whether being halfway through my allocation is good or bad. Mm-hmm. If I'm almost at the end of my month, I can go crazy. If it's only one day into my month, I better be careful. And they never provided a graphical presentation of how far through the billing month I was. So that was the problem to be solved.
That would have been pretty easy for them to do, but hey, they didn't do it for you.
I've loudly complained several times about this. Nothing's happened. So I thought, I can do that. And I built an app it's very simple. You have to, you know, enter in how much you've used. But in the settings, you have your billing date and your total allocation. And now when you enter in how much you've used, you see two bars. And if the usage bar is advancing beyond where the time bar is, then you have a problem. And in fact, I've even put a little smiley face there if it's okay and a sad face or shocked face if it's looking too bad.
Horror.
So that was a very specific problem to be solved. And that was the one on my list that I decided was going to be the simplest. So that's the one I tackled first. And it's available for sale today.
Is it really?
Yep. I put a price on it because I thought, you know what? I've spent time on this.
We spent $100.
Well, I spent $100 as well, but I kind of say to myself I was going to spend that anyway, and that's not part of my recovery because I'll just do it anyway. But yeah, I've put it out there. It's called CapMate. And my total sales, let's just say I'm not running out of digits on my hands and feet yet. But that doesn't concern me. It was the act of getting it there that was the win for me.
So let me ask you, what about the difference between the stores? Is it in all stores or only the New Zealand store?
It's in all from memory. I can control where it's released. So, for example, if I was, you know, releasing an app that I can't think of an example actually, because tourists are always an option for buying stuff for New Zealand specific apps, for example. But you know, there may be something like the train system here. You know, there's not much point somebody outside New Zealand knowing what time the trains arrive in Wellington. Partly because tourists wouldn't use them. But I think I put it in every country, and there's rather a lot.
So do you have to type every country?
No, you can sort of select all or go through and select an individual country. I think I started with 5 countries and then decided to expand it to more very shortly thereafter.
We just made another dollar. I just bought it.
Hey. Oh, 70 cents, to be honest.
Oh, that's right. Sorry. So you don't have to use your toes to count yet.
One of these days, I'll sell enough for Apple to actually send me a check.
Oh, do you have to get to a threshold?
I believe so. But anyway, as I say, that one, the goal of that one was to get it in the App Store and, you know, tick the box. So, hey, I've actually done this. I've published it.
Look at that.
The next one is actually going to be useful to a lot more people.
Oh, man. Did I buy the wrong one?
I don't know. Did you buy the right one or the wrong one?
No. But you're saying there's another one that's more useful. Right.
I will get you in on the beta test of this when it gets to the point where it's functionally complete. But at the moment, I'm still adding features. Find a problem to be solved and then see the learning stuff that we just covered earlier, because that's how you get your first app there is to actually have a goal. Another friend of mine decided that he was having trouble creating estimates for clients on some type of work that he was doing, so he created an estimation app. Now, having decided that you've got this problem to be solved and knowing how to learn how to solve it, here are the things that I found were the biggest hurdles for me. Bearing in mind that I'm a programmer by hobby and by trade, these are the things that really tripped me up. First of all, syntax. Now, there's a caveat to this. Objective-C, which was until recently the only language to use, is picky and complex. What's the phrase I used to use? A punctuation farm. There's more symbols than there are letters and numbers in a lot of the code, and there's square brackets and there's round brackets and there's semicolons and then there's equals and there's double equals and then there's nested square and round brackets and stuff like that. And when you first look at that, you think, what on earth does that all mean? And that's where finding the right low level tutorials actually works really, really well. And that Become an Xcoder book that I mentioned, I think covered that area particularly well, and it slowly built you up with these different syntaxes. Because what happens is, it's like regular expressions. You know, you learn how to do a range of characters, and you learn how to do a wildcard, and you learn how to do a set. Put brackets around things to refer to them, you know, one or many times, and that kind of thing. So you learn all those very basic things, but when you put them all together, it looks massively complex if that's what you start with. So you have to learn all the individual pieces and then learn how to build them together. And then when you see the big thing, you'll be able to mentally break it down into all the little pieces.
I never got past those brackets and stuff. I mean, I never did figure out what they were doing with all of those.
Yeah.
I don't think the instruction I had was as good as what you got.
Yeah, it can get very, very complex very, very quickly, especially when you start referring to something which refers to something which refers to something which refers to something, and you end up nesting at 5 or 6 levels deep and starting to wonder when you think, oh, hang on, I just need to put a +1 in there somewhere. It's which bracket does that go inside? Now, Swift is magical, is what I've written in the show notes, because Swift actually, I've seen various descriptions of Swift saying, it's strongly typed and it allows you to do things and it stops you from doing things. It's sane is the definition that I'm using. Objective-C lets you do all sorts of things that are just crazy, that basically say, hey, there's a cliff here, but I'm not going to put a fence up. That's cool. You can walk along the cliff. In fact, I encourage you to walk along the cliff if you want to do this. And Swift says, don't be silly. There's a path over there. Let's use it.
Oh, okay.
It's got so many things in it that I've picked up in various other languages that, are the way that I would prefer to do it, because it just makes more sense. It seems like the right way to do it. without letting you be silly. Objective C, which is largely based on C.
It keeps you from making mistakes?
It does keep you from making mistakes, and it leads you down paths. A lot of the book that Apple wrote about Swift, a lot of it says, we've done this so that it's less confusing when you're reading the code. So it's really aimed at being obvious what it's doing, and therefore you're more likely to, you know, do what you want. And also, if somebody's modifying code, they're far more easily going to be able to figure out what it's doing.
Do you think we'll end up with fewer giant problems like the missing squirrely bracket there that yes. caused all the grief a while back?
Yes, I think that's a big part of it. It'll be quicker to write, easier to understand, and easier to fix, you know, easier to maintain.
And in real life, I think people more often are helping each other's code too. You don't have just standalone developers all the time. I mean,
no,
indie developers, sure, but in the base code of the way things work, it's usually a whole lot of people working together. So
yeah,
you're changing and someone else's code.
At work, I think I'm up to two programs that I've written from scratch and not started by copying something else,
okay.
either one of mine or somebody else's. So, you know, yeah, it's always the work of a lot of people. I don't think there's any such thing as something that's entirely the work of one person.
Right, right.
Now, the thing with this syntax, both Swift and Objective-C, is I've said Xcode is the teacher with the ruler. Now, we used to call it the meter rule. I assume it would have been a yard ruler in the United States.
Yardstick, they call it.
Yardstick. And when you weren't paying attention in class and that thing came smacking down on your desk and got your attention back to where it should be.
All right.
That's what Xcode does. It's amazing, to be honest. Xcode has actually taught me some of the intricacies of Objective-C because it just keeps underlining things and saying, didn't you mean this?
Oh, good.
Did you want to put a semicolon there? Oh, yes, sorry. I'm supposed to put a semicolon there. You started typing something. Would you like to choose from this list of things that match what you've typed? And you can just, you can almost sort of think your way through the line with Xcode filling in the details as you go.
Well, Objective-C did a little bit of that. I remember it would give you a little bit of, start typing one of the commands and it would fill in the rest of it for you and put the brackets around it and that sort of thing.
Yeah, that's Xcode doing that for you. And it'll do the same for Swift as well. So
okay.
It intelligently looks at your code.
Oh, right.
Puts up little signs saying, well, you know, you've created this variable, but you haven't used it yet anywhere. Little things like that. So it's very, very useful in leading you on all the little detail stuff. So that took a bit of getting used to. The user interface paradigms. How do you put stuff in a view? Well, what is a view for that matter? How do I put stuff in a view? How do I get the user input when the user touches the screen? How do I know they've touched it so I can do something? When I know they've touched it, how do I update the screen? And well, what if I want to move to this other screen and how do I get back? And all those kinds of things. I had one example for a while where I had my application. I thought, okay, I'll put a button here. And when I tap that button, I'll slide this other view into view. And then I couldn't figure out how to get back. And the only way to get back was to, you know, double tap the home button, swipe up to kill the app and run it again.
Maybe not a good way to have your program stay, right?
No. And to be honest, I'm still not 100% sure how that works, but I figured out a way to do it. And the way was tell it that it's a temporary screen and then, you know, when they tap the button, just tell them to close off the temporary screen.
Oh, okay.
But I don't know how, for example, I would go through a third screen if I needed to. So there's a lot of stuff that's like, it's very, very simple stuff from the point of view of how you operate an application on an iPhone. But how do I do that? How do I make that thing slide like that? How do I make the thing bounce at the bottom or animate or all sorts of things? And these are all these massive numbers of APIs that you have to get your head around. And this is where Stack Overflow really comes into its own because you start asking questions like, how do I make this thing do this like the Apple app does? And a lot of the time you get an answer and sometimes you get, they don't let you do that.
Oh, right.
So you got to get past all of that stuff. And that's just the user interface. Then there's all the other APIs. What if you want to work with date and time? I mean, you could write your own code to subtract dates, but don't, because there's stuff in the operating system that will do that for you. But how do you use that? And you know what? If you want to subtract one date from another, you have to know that we are using the Gregorian calendar. And hey, if you want your app to run in China and it to make sense to people, maybe you need to encounter the Chinese calendar and deal with that. And it all starts getting very complex very quickly. All I wanted to do was figure out how many days it was since my last billing date. Very simple subtraction.
Pretty soon it's asking you, which was it an African swallow, right?
Yeah, carrying coconuts, indeed. Maths, you know, I've heard somebody say recently, you don't have to be good at maths to do programming. Perhaps. It depends what you're trying to achieve, but you do have to have numeracy. And, you know, you need to figure out, like, if you're drawing stuff on the screen, you'll probably need geometry of some sort, even, you know, very basic geometry. Data arithmetic gets kind of interesting, you know, working out numbers of months and days and their relationship to one another.
Right.
If you're doing geometry, how do I calculate the cosine of an angle? And, oh, whoops, you need it in radians and I've kind of got it in degrees. And hang on, the coordinate system on the screen, you know, moving on to graphics now, the coordinates on the screen start at the top left and go down and right. Which is not my mental space. And this is so crazy that when I started looking at how to draw text onto the screen, not just with a label, but text that I was drawing in different places, by default, it draws it upside down. I thought that can't be right. And I put the code in, and sure enough, it drew the text upside down.
Now, is that because you were using the wrong coordinates?
No, that's the default. It actually said it in the documentation. It says the coordinate system that this particular text thing uses is the same as something else, and therefore, by default, the text will be upside down.
And that's a you got to do something.
Exactly. And these are all the little idiosyncrasies, and that's where your maths is going to have to come in, because you need to, you know, apply a transformation matrix. Right. And
yeah.
It just, you know, it's very hard to do anything without maths, anything. Beyond the, you know, very basic stuff where you let the operating system do most of it for you. And then there's abstractions and encapsulations, I've called them, which is where, you know, a date is this thing, and you've got to learn how to set the date on this thing. And then you've got to learn how to say, well, hey, you date thingy, can you subtract 4 days and tell me what that comes back as? But hang on, I want it in this format so that I can show it to the user. And so figuring out how all these things are created and how they behave, you know, all these different APIs. So, I mean, you know, dates is a really simple example. I've written
code. That's a great example because it sounds so simple.
Yeah. You know, I've written code at work to subtract 4 days, you know, and it says, well, if the date of the month is greater than 4, easy peasy. But if it's less than 4, then you've got to work out, okay, I've got to subtract 1 from the month, which means that maybe also subtract 1 from the year. And meanwhile, how many days did the previous month have? So, and it gets complex very fast.
Do you have to teach it to sing 30 days of September, April, June, and November?
Not that, but you have to sing a whole lot of other songs. So all these endless APIs, the documentation is fairly detailed, but it often lacks context. So, okay, here's this date thing, but How do I
use it in this context?
I can create it, but how do I make it do this? And theoretically, all the information's in there, but joining up, doing this with a date, and doing this with a calendar, and doing this with a formatting text to the screen, putting those three things together is like finding three needles in three haystacks.
So I wanted to combine two thoughts. You're talking about the endless APIs that are there, and then we talked about how rapid things change. With iOS 8, they said there's 4,000 new APIs. Does that mean that 2,000 of the existing ones changed and there's 2,000 more, or there's 4,000 more, or do you have to relearn a bunch?
I take it as there are 4,000 more, and all the previous goodness knows how many thousands still exist. So. Okay. And generally speaking, the concept of an API is that the behavior most of the time doesn't change. It will add behavior. So, you know, for example, today you take a date and you can add or subtract days, and then they, you know, bring an update out and you can add or subtract months. So you can still add or subtract days and it still behaves the same, but now there's more capabilities and they might be more suitable for what you're doing.
Okay. Okay, so you might still be able to do it the hard way you were doing it, but if you figure out the new ones, you might have an advantage. Okay.
Yeah, okay. And a new API might be saying, well, now we have an API that represents an appointment, which has got more, you know, includes a date, but has more information as well.
Okay, okay.
The next one that was really hard to get for me was Model View Controller. Now, I won't labor too long on this, but it's the way that you divide up what your application looks like, which is the view, what your application is actually representing, which is the model, and how those two things work together, which is the controller.
Yep, I never figured out what any of that meant. I got stuck on that, and I could say the words. But grokking it, as you said, is a little different than being able to replicate the words.
I learned the concept and I fully understand it. And then I write the code and I get to a point where I think, hang on, how on earth am I going to do this? And what I've learned is that when you get to that point, and it's like, hang on, this seems impossible. It means you've got Model View Controller wrong and something's in the wrong place. And every time I've hit this stumbling block, I've said, actually, yeah, this should be over here. And I've moved some capability from either the M, the V, or the C to one of the others, and all of a sudden it makes sense again. So the best way to learn is to figure out how to do the impossible things.
Okay, I got it.
And probably the biggest hurdle of all, and this will certainly be getting better by the sounds of it, is building the darn things and sending them out. The provisioning profile pandemonium. There's a link in the show notes to an article that a friend pointed me to when I just said, how on earth does this bleep work? It's nightmarish. There have been multiple articles I've seen on the net that try to explain how this stuff works, and they're all completely different. And it's changed over time, which makes it even more complex. But I honestly had the most trouble of all. I had my application working. I had it running on my phone. It's like, cool, let's get this up to the App Store. And that took me, I think, a couple of days in the end to figure that out.
So this is just getting it up to the store, not getting it out to anybody yet.
Well, getting it out to anybody was difficult as well. But the getting it up to the store just adds layers onto that. And you end up dealing with certificates and provisioning profiles and developer IDs. And I still don't know what half of them are. It's just I've found a combination that works. I'm sticking with it.
Wow. So now you've got your app written. You've managed to beat the Model View Controller into submission. You've got your app up there. What do you do next? Make giant piles of money.
Yeah. And there has been much discussion in about the last month or so about pricing models. And the word on the street, if you believe some people, is that there's no money to be made unless you fluke it. There seems to be a suggestion that in-app purchases is the way to go. And certainly one example of that is the Overcast podcast app that I mentioned earlier, where he has released it for free. And there are two key features in the application that are his differentiators, and those are an in-app purchase.
So I haven't used Overcast yet, and I've heard a lot of people, and I think Terry Austin is going to end up doing a review for us of it, so I don't want to spoil it here, but I don't quite understand how you can test out let me back up. I think that the biggest problem here is that Apple doesn't let you have a trial version. If they let you have a 10-day free trial, you could test out all the capability and then decide whether to buy it or not, and then you could get rid of this whole in-app freemium kind of model. It's an unnatural aberration because they don't let you do that.
Yep.
And something like what you've just described, the one thing that makes it differentiate is the one thing you can't see when you get the free version of the app. So why would you ever?
Okay, so that's where Marco got clever. He allows you to use these features for 10 minutes.
So he did create a way
free.
To do a trial.
Yeah, I'm not sure what the mechanics are. I assume that there's like some key that you can check in your application to say, have they bought this add-on? So he has said,
well, that's perfect,
you can use these features for 10 minutes and then they go away.
Okay,
you
so you can
it.
See the key differentiator. So he's figured out a way to do a trial. That's cool.
Yeah, but still, you know, the model is that he decided he had to make the application free and accept that some people will use it without those features and he gets nothing for it.
Mm-hmm.
Although he also had a a sort of altruistic view of, you know, making podcast listening easy for people. And he thought, you know, his way was the best way, as all podcast app makers, I'm sure, would. So, there was that angle for him, but it seems to be that, you know, you put out a free app and you have in-app purchases of some description. Now, you know, how would I do that for CapMate? I'm not sure. Yeah, it allows you to have three sets of figures, one for your MiFi, one for your cell phone, and one for your home broadband. So, you know, perhaps you only get one until you do an in-app purchase and then you get the other two. I don't know. Probably doesn't really apply to that particular app, but I am actually seriously considering it for my next one, as to having some of the, what I think are the differentiating features as in-app purchases.
Okay. All right. So is that the end of the story?
Pretty much. Number two app's probably not going to be out before the end of the year at this rate, because I'm just sort of doing it in my spare time.
But sounds like you're having a real good time at it.
Yeah, there are moments where I kind of get stuck behind major problems that aren't really fun, but I'll get there in the end.
Well, Alistair, I really appreciate you coming on the show and telling us all of this stuff. This is great. I really enjoyed learning from it. And you're right, we did not get into any propeller head stuff I was worried about.
Well, I'm expecting to see your app very soon now, Alison.
Well, we'll see. We'll see. I'm not going to learn Objective-C, I can tell you that. I'm going to back up and wait until Swift is ready. So that'll be where I'll get started. So, all right. Well, so how can people find you? What kind of stuff do you want to plug?
Everything me these days is on my personal site, zkarj.me. And the most common place to find me online will be on Twitter, which is twitter.com/ZKARJ.
All right, Alistair, thanks again. And thank you so much for picking up the slack when I go on vacation too. I know people love it when you have the show going.
Oh, it's always a bit of stressful fun for me too.
All right. Thanks a lot. Talk to you soon.
Okay, bye.
All right, well, that's going to wind up a long show for this week. Many thanks to our sponsor for helping to pay the bills, Blue Mango Learning, over at bluemangolearning.com, makers of the fabulous Clarify 2. Do not forget to send in your dumb questions, comments, and suggestions by emailing me at allison@podfeet.com. I know you guys have heard that a lot of times, but I actually had somebody ask me at work who listens to the show, and you know who you are, hey, what's your email address? I'm thinking, really? You've heard it 150 times. Anyway, email me at allison@podfeet.com. You can follow me on Twitter and app.net at Podfeet. Check out the NoSilicast Google Plus community. Like I said, we're having a lot of fun over there. George from Tulsa just did some stuff. Stephen Getz. We're watching Switcher Mark and all of his crazy, fabulous photos of eagles. I don't like that guy. He takes so much better photos than me. Anyway, we're having a lot of fun. So go check it out at podfeet.com/Google+. If you want to join in the fun of the live show and things are getting more interesting, we're going to try to move over to Google Hangouts if we can get it to work. And you can do that by heading over to podfeet.com/live on Sunday nights at 5 p.m. Pacific time. You can always go there. I'm always going to keep that steady. No matter what service we're using, I'll embed it there. So just remember, podfeet.com/live, bookmark it, make it your homepage, whatever you got to do. When you do that, you can join the friendly and enthusiastic NoSilicastaways. Thanks for listening and stay subscribed.